This is Everyday Bravery, a podcast about finding the courage to tackle whatever life throws at you. And in this episode, our last of the season, three stories of bravery from people facing serious and unexpected life changes. I'm Meg Wilcox, and today, Everyday Bravery Starts Over, a podcast from Prudential. Brendan Leonard has been a travel and adventure writer for more than a decade. He's done interesting things, like walk across America twice, or lived out of a converted van for 3 years while climbing mountains in the West. But before he could enjoy his dream job, he had to face a harsh reality. His addiction to alcohol was ruining his life. A day came when he realized he had to change, and change quickly. So he started over. Before he could go rock climbing, he had to hit rock bottom.
March 1st, 2002, I went out after work for a couple of beers with my friend. I didn't have a driver's license because I had gotten a previous drunk driving arrest nearly 6 months before that, so I was about to get my driver's license back. And I'm in the passenger seat, so no worries for me to just sit in the passenger seat of a car. And he pulled up in front of his house to run in to get a jacket or a sweater. I'm drunk. He was taking forever, so I just grabbed the gear shift of the car and just put it in drive and let the car roll a few feet, you know, 20, 30, 40 feet. Put it back in park to stop it, and then suddenly there's blue lights behind me. Oh no, this is bad. And I look back and the police are back there, and they pull up next to the car and they say, "Do you have a driver's license?" I'm like, "I don't have a driver's license." You know, I'm sitting in the passenger seat. They know that the car has not moved itself, so they know I've been driving it. So they arrest me, and I realize, like, it's over for me. So I go to jail. I wake up, you know, I'm freezing in this, you know, concrete bunk. This is the modern jail cell. You know, it's not bars like you would think, you know. And I woke up and looked up at the glass with the wires in it. So if you break the glass, you still can't get through it. And I think to myself, this is it. Rock bottom, as they say in substance abuse circles. They write in dry erase marker your name and your birth date on the glass, you know, like that's who's in this cell, and how much your bond is. And my bond was $3,000, you know, which I thought was excessive. You know, like, "Oh, guys, I'm not a criminal. I just, you know," and you're like, "Yeah, you are a criminal." I had this feeling, you know, like, I wonder if my dad was on that day in 1979 was looking through glass just like this at, like, all the cribs in the hospital. They picked me out, having all these dreams for me, you know, like, "Oh, I wonder if he's going to be, you know, a doctor, a lawyer, a baseball player," like one of the, whatever dads do, you know, when they see their kid, you know, who's like literally one day old. And I thought, I'm not doing any of these things. I am just a huge disappointment. Like, that's what I am right now. And I was sick of disappointing people. That was the last day I ever drank. It wasn't even that fulfilling. It wasn't even that good of a beer. You know, I think back and it's just too bad. Lucky for me, the state of Iowa said, "You have to go to rehab." I knew that was coming, but I couldn't get into a treatment program for 3 months. So I just kind of white knuckled it, as they say. And just like, I didn't drink for 3 months beforehand. And I showed up and I was like, "I'm cured, guys." And they're like, no, you got to do the 5 weeks. And I did. And it was a wonderful thing. But it's totally changed my life. I was 4 weeks into treatment. I had to go to a friend's wedding. I was in the wedding, you know, I was an usher, and all my friends from high school were there. And that's what you do at a wedding. You know, most people have a couple drinks. Usually I would have had, you know, a dozen. And I had to sit there and just, like, through the rehearsal dinner, riding on the party bus or whatever from the wedding venue to the reception venue, and everybody, of course, is drinking. And it was just like, it was so hard for me to do that, but I can't screw this up. It was the thing I had to do right. It's not like I can say, "Yeah, guys, I quit drinking 3 years ago. I quit drinking 4 months ago." That's not a huge track record, you know? People are, like, still going, "Oh, yeah, but you could just have a beer, right?" I moved west and was kind of treading water in life. I didn't really know what I wanted to do or what I could be in life, but I know this one thing that I can't do, which is drink. It's not working out for me. I was just getting into hiking in the mountains a little bit and kind of had this inkling of, like, this could be a thing. You know, like, I really like how I feel out here. I feel small, but I'm in awe, but I also feel kind of accomplished that I got to this place. And I wasn't exactly sure how to go about doing all this stuff, but I really enjoyed it. You know, I go home for Christmas, and my brother, he bought this climbing rope a year before and hadn't ended up using it. So he threw it in a box and put it under the tree, and it was uncoiled, no packaging whatsoever. I opened it up, and I was like, you know, I don't really think I need to do this, like, adrenaline junkie, like, type of vertical rock scaling, you know, like, whatever people do. But I take the rope back to Phoenix with me. I'm like, climbing ropes aren't cheap. So I had the most expensive piece of gear already. So the guys I worked with said, you should come out with us. You know, you might as well try it. And I was bad at it and thought, I hate this. Like, this is terrifying. I don't know why people would ever do this for fun. I was pretty convinced I was never going to do it again. I ended up moving to Colorado and taking a lesson, actually, from a guide. And it stuck the second time. I don't know what the difference was. You know, maybe I was a little more mature. But it really took, and then I realized that there's this incredible way of exploring the world. You tie yourself into a rope, and immediately when you leave the ground, you have this incredible gravity to your situation, you know, no pun intended. At some point on a route, you will usually have this clarity. Work goes away, you know, any relationship problems you have go away. Everything goes away, and you have this complete focus on what you're doing. I hadn't experienced anything like that, this complete relaxation where your mind just stops, you know, since I was drinking. So in a really weird way, it put me in the same mental state as drinking. And you only get it for a few minutes when you're climbing, but I became really obsessed with it. People say, well, did you just transfer addictions? I'm like, yeah, kind of in a way, I guess. I wasn't getting arrested for rock climbing. That was a refreshing thing. I look back on that and I think, I can't believe I was heartbroken that I was not going to be able to just sit on a bar stool and drink. Had you told me at the time, like, look, you have to quit drinking. It's going to suck. You know, you're not going to know how to relate to people. You're not going to know how to make friends. You're not ever going to be able to go to a party and feel like one of the crowd there. Like, it's going to really be bad and it's going to be pretty lonely for a couple of years. But you do get to go to Switzerland, you know, and play in the mountains, and you get to go to Norway, and you get to ride your bicycle across America, and like all these fantastic things that I've got to do. I'm pretty sure I would have made the choice. I would have said, yeah, okay, that sounds like a good deal. But at the time, I was heartbroken. I was like, God, I'm 23. This is what people do. They party, you know. And but now, like, would I make that choice? Absolutely, I think. Do I regret it at all? Not in the least. So.
Brendan Leonard is a travel and adventure writer. His latest book is called The Great Outdoors, A User's Guide. Each of us plays a few roles in our families. We're the provider, the rule maker, and the taxi. The table setter, the barbecuer, and the dishwasher. The bank teller, the laundry folder, the referee. Todd Gangaware played every family role there is. A loyal husband and dad to two girls, he felt it was his responsibility to care for the entire household. And they loved him for it. But once Todd was gone, everything very nearly fell apart. This next story is about what happens when the person you depend on is suddenly no longer there. It's a story about how even the simplest problems can seem overwhelming at first. And it's how a little bravery can help a family heal.
I'm not really scared of anything anymore because the worst possible thing that could have ever happened to me already happened. So now anything life throws at me, I'm prepared for.
Okay, my name is Denise Gangaware. I am 51. I'm a third grade teacher and a mom. I have two girls.
I'm Kaylee, and I'm Todd's oldest daughter.
I'm Kellyanne Gangaware. I'm my dad's youngest daughter.
18, Kellyanne, and Kaylee, 23.
The interesting thing about my dad was...
My dad played 100% of the roles in our family.
Oh my gosh. He did everything.
He was always either sweeping the floors. He always cooked dinner every day. He packed my lunch.
He would, decorate and do things of that sort. He would...
Literally sew, my dance costumes. He would...
Help me with lesson plans. I would come up with...
He was the chauffeur.
He did everything.
I don't really know how he did it now that I think and, look back on it.
I just always knew my dad, would be there. He was always there. It's, weird because I can totally see it all happening. It plays out in my head, even though I wasn't there.
It was his heart. I went to work. It was a Thursday afternoon, October 8th.
She told me that she came home from school and...
I walked into the house and screamed, "What's going on, Pops?" And I didn't hear a response. And then I walked upstairs and I dropped my bag and I saw him at the head of the kitchen table.
She said he was slumped over.
But
she knew he was kidding because he would normally play a joke like that. And then she'd go over and he'd scare her.
He would do that a lot if he wouldn't breathe. And then I would get really close to him and he would go, "Bah!" And then I would scream out of my skin and be so scared. I was hesitant. I was like, "Dad, I'm not falling for it. I'm not going over there." Until I finally went over and I thought something wasn't right. And I picked him up and...
God knows how she did it because he was not a small man. But she got him up and she got him onto the floor. And she did CPR.
Well, I called 911, but I wanted him so badly to wake up.
And then they came and they were working on him, and that's when she called me.
I was in the hospital by myself for a while because I was the only one that was home. My sister was working in the city and my mom was working in Chatham.
I wasn't living at home. I was working out on Long Island.
So she drove and she met us at the hospital.
And then once I got there...
And said, "Where is he? Where's dad?" And my mom just gave her a look and my sister screamed the scream that I can still pretty much hear so loudly. And that's when I knew that nothing was going back.
And the first thing I said was, "Oh my God, what are we going to do?" I just knew my dad did everything for us. I immediately knew that we were in such trouble. Our whole world is gone.
I think it was pretty eye-opening to me realizing once he was gone how much he really did for us with not just all the big things, but with finances, obviously. And
I never had to worry about how, they were going to pay the mortgage or just keep the TV on.
And there were nights where I stayed up and I was thinking, well, I might not be able to do this. Even if I work another job.
Everything in our house just started breaking. Our stove broke. My mom's ceiling in her room fell in. It was every appliance in our house that we used every day started breaking that our dad would have known how to fix or taken care of.
I just thought, this is just too much work and too much stress and too sad. I just don't want to do it. But we had to make it work. We had to make it work. And I remember thinking that I was nagging him about a budget. And he brushed me off. And, as far as I knew, he didn't do anything. But I said I was bothering him about that. I'm like, let me just... Middle of the night, it was 2 in the morning. I got up and I got on the computer and I started just poking around. And sure enough, he had made a budget. And I wondered too, did he know? Maybe he just did it, but he had notes on it. He had little notes on the bottom of things I could do, consolidate these at a lower interest rate or do I don't know if I felt maybe he was giving that message to me. I don't know if he was doing it with the intent of talking to me. I don't know, but
I took that and that got me started, you know? I think I was just really, really scared. Like, I was really worried about my sister and my mom. I looked at the budget and I looked at the bills, and then I knew what my paycheck was. And I looked at my little girl who needs to go to college, and I didn't think we were going to be able to do it, you know? Like, I didn't know what we were going to be able to do.
Every time I did bring it up, my mom would just reassure me, saying, you're going wherever you want to go. Don't worry about money. You're going to do what you love. Don't worry about anything, which obviously it was in the back of my head. I didn't know how I was going to do it, how we were going to afford anything.
But with every bill that we tackled or figured out, I felt a little more capable. I think when I'd finally retweaked the budget, I brought it in, and I sat down with a financial advisor. Then he kind of validated that. Like, he said, like, you're on the right track. And I walked out of there and I felt like, you know, like I can take control of this now. I can do this. And
I think getting my sister off to school was, I mean, that moment was when we dropped her off at school, was just like the culmination of all of the things that we'd like learned how to do, and the little steps that we took, like, all came together in this one moment. It's like, wow, okay, if we can like get Kellyanne to school, we can do anything.
And we're gonna be okay. Yeah.
That's Denise, Kaylee, and Kellyanne Gangaware, showing us how, when families band together, they find what they need to overcome and become stronger. Life isn't a dress rehearsal. Starting a family or a business, you take the leap and trust you'll land on your feet. This is Everyday Bravery, a podcast about having the courage to live your dream. From Prudential.
So when I was really young, I went to somebody who was telling fortunes, and he looked at me and he said, this child is going to go very far and she's going to leave the country and go overseas. And, you know, this was 40 years ago and people weren't leaving in droves. So anyway, it planted an idea in my head. And by the time I was 20, I was determined to leave. I feel like I was born in the wrong country. I moved 10,000 miles away from home, from India, and I haven't moved 50 miles since. So I came here to go to grad school and I've pretty much stayed in Texas.
Urvashi Petre came to America in 1986. She left her home in Pune, India, and settled in Dallas. Traveling halfway across the world to start a new life is brave, but it's not even the most remarkable part of her personal journey. Once settled into her new home, Urvashi completed her graduate studies and then built a career in marketing and analyzing data. She worked her way up to Chief Marketing Information Officer for a global advertising agency. So far, so good. Except,
you know, I was making money for other people, and I've always wanted to run my own business, and I didn't want to die wondering. And so I figured, well, if you're going to do it, there is no perfect time, just do it. So I quit and decided to go into business about 6 years ago. And it was immediately successful. So I had many clients come through the door almost immediately.
She was living the American dream. She'd relocated to the other side of the world, had a successful career as a marketing executive, and then struck out on her own to start a business. The risks were paying off. Life was nearly perfect. Until one day at the gym.
I was lifting weights, and I started to feel some pain. And we thought that I had overdone it because, of course, I overdo everything, right? So
it started with something a lot of us have experienced, a bit of pain in the joints. But within a couple of months, her health had declined to a shocking degree.
It comes on so slowly. So first, you're not walking as well. Then you need a little help getting undressed and dressed. Then you find you can't get in and out of the bathtub. You could be sitting on a couch perfectly healthy 1 minute, and you get up half an hour later and you realize you can't walk because you've had a flare-up while you were sitting down unanticipated. It progressed to the point where I couldn't have a sheet on my body because the sheet hurt. And my husband was having to hold up a glass of water because I couldn't hold up a glass of water. Next thing you knew, I was in a walker. And then next thing you knew, I couldn't even walk and I was in a wheelchair.
Initially, doctors thought her she had rheumatoid arthritis, or RA. She was put on a treatment plan. But after several months, her doctor reassessed the diagnosis. He told her she had Lyme disease.
Here's the thing. There is no cure for RA, but there is a cure for Lyme disease. And I desperately wanted to have something that was curable. So I believed him. I believed him even though my gut was going, there's something wrong here. So what happened was he took me off the RA medications and he put me on treatment for Lyme disease. And I was on 60 different medications a day. And on top of that, they put me on methadone for pain management. And methadone is a highly addictive drug. These additional meds almost killed me. And I went from somebody who was coping with life and with pain, to somebody who was just serially debilitated. What I realized is that when you're sick, it's a lot harder for people around you than it is for you. You know, people think that the one who's sick is the one who's suffering. What's really difficult is, I'm sorry. What's really hard is to watch the people around you and to feel what they are and to know that they feel helpless. I'm sorry. It's hard because they love you and they're watching you in pain and there's nothing they can do. And day after day, night after night, they have to watch that. And you know how it is when you love somebody, you want to do everything to make them feel better, and there was nothing anybody could do. And that's the hardest part. It's hard for them, and it's hard for you to watch that you're putting your loved ones through the situation that they can't change. And there just came a point when I had to say, this can't go on, that I am not prepared to live like this. More importantly, I'm not prepared to put my family through this. They had no life except taking care of me, and that was not fair to anybody.
In constant pain and confined to a wheelchair, she shut down her business she'd worked so hard to build.
And so not only did I get sick, but in the midst of all that, I had to resign the businesses that I did have because I was in no shape to give them the attention that they deserved. So it's kind of funny, actually, but my P&G clients, I wanted to finish the project out, but I was bedridden. So two of them came to the house, and I was in bed with a laptop, and my husband put in a desk and chairs, and they sat at the desk and chairs, and we managed to crank out the last of the deliverables. But I had to resign all of it. And, when I got sick, I wasn't even able to think about how to make a living for me and my family.
The doctors were telling her one thing, that she had Lyme disease. But as her illness dragged on, she became convinced her body was telling her something else, that she wasn't getting what she needed to survive.
I was not going to go down without a fight. I knew they were wrong. I basically had to choose. I had to decide who I was going to trust. Was I going to trust somebody whose treatment had not been effective? Was I going to trust myself? Was I going to give myself a chance?
It was a terrifying time. She had to be brave and go against the advice of the medical professionals. But one thing about Irvishi, she'd been going against the grain most of her life. So she drew on lessons she'd learned about facing adversity. Life lesson number one.
Life doesn't come with guarantees. And so I think the trick in that for me has been to accept that I am going to be afraid and to be able to accept that a couple of things. One, how you feel doesn't matter. What you do is going to matter. And the other thing, I think, too, is to be able to harness that fear and go, why am I afraid? And the thing that makes, I think, most of us afraid is the fear of failure. To feel the fear is fine. To give in to the fear is not. And to use the fear is the best way forward, is to use that to motivate you. And it took, again, you know, a lot of courage to say the establishment is wrong. The diagnosis is wrong. I actually know what I'm doing. I know what I'm feeling. And I'm going to take my own treatment into my own hands. And so I went in and asked to be treated for RA. And, you know, I got a shot. A week later, I was out of the wheelchair. But I had to learn everything again. I had to learn to walk. I had to learn to sit on the floor, how to get up, getting in and out of the bathtub. Everything had to be relearned. And I had to take myself cold turkey off of methadone, which was a six-week process where I barely slept. I paced up and down. And, you know, you just have to gut it out. There is no easy way out of that one.
With that gutsy move, her health was on the mend. But it had already cost her. She'd shuttered her business and was unemployed. Her family struggled financially. So the next step seemed obvious. Start over.
I knew now by this time what it takes to start a business. I'd gone through it once, and here I was, barely recovered, and I was deciding to do it again. And I think that was a moment where, you know, the line between bravery and foolishness is sometimes you can only judge after the fact, right? It's hard enough to start a business once, and I was going to do it a second time when I was, at that point, the sole breadwinner for the family.
Which brings us to Urvashi's life lesson number two.
The only thing I can control is my own actions. I judge myself on, did you make your phone calls? You know, did you do your outreach? Did you do what you should have done in order to get to where you're trying to get? Not on whether or not that resulted in your business. And that was a huge mind shift for me, to accept that I don't control the outcome, I control my actions. Judge yourself on whether or not you performed the right actions.
For her, being brave doesn't mean you're not afraid. It means moving forward, even when you're scared.
And you know, it's a terrifying time in a lot of ways. And I get up every day afraid, I go to bed every night afraid, and during the day I do what I need to do. You come to a place of acceptance. And when fear is a companion, not a threat, it's a whole different way of looking at the world, I think.
And Urvashi's life lesson number three? Confronting what's probably the biggest pressure point for modern life. Finding balance.
And you hear a lot about how people are stretched in every direction and you know, how work-life balance is so hard to come by. And I feel like that's setting unrealistic expectations, that in any given day, there will not be balance. There will be times when there's a deliverable. There will be, you know, at work, there will be times when you and your husband need a little more attention toward each other. There will be times when there's a sick child. And I think if we switched our perspective to balance being something that is achieved over a span of time versus a point in time, that we might take some of the pressure off of ourselves. And, you know, you still get to experience all of those roles. You still get to grow from them. You don't have to put, you know, 25, 25, 25, 25% of your time towards four different things before there's balance.
Beyond this medical crisis, Urvashi Petre has lived bravery in so many elements of her life. None of it's been easy. Today, she has her life back. Her health is stabilized, and though she still has the occasional joint pain, it's manageable. She's back at the helm of her data analytics company, and her clients have returned.
I don't know that I think I'll be successful at everything I try, right? Nobody's successful at everything you try. What I do know is I'll survive, that I will still be who I am at the heart of me, and I will live to fight another day, another battle. And that belief comes from having taken chances and having taken risks and failed and succeeded. And the more you do it, it's like muscle memory. It's like going to the gym to lift weights. The more times you fight something and you survive, the more you realize that there are many of these things will not kill you. And they have the potential to enrich your life. So that's the trade-off that you have to deal with every day, right?
That's how everyday bravery starts over. And that's a wrap on Everyday Bravery for now. We'd like to know what you enjoyed about the series. Find us on Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and a review. You can also share your Everyday Bravery stories with Prudential on social media. Find us on Twitter and Facebook and use the hashtag Everyday Bravery. I'm Meg Wilcox. And as always, I hope you are brave in your everyday life, wherever your travel, your work, or your family takes you. Everyday Bravery from Prudential. Bring your challenges.